soldiers who bust their guns. And name of freedom, not the game of funds. True queens who raise their kids, implement the knowledge, show them how to live. This is for those who stand in line to feed their babies while we're running out of time. This is for the injustice behind
bars. Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. It's the life. Welcome to another edition of Spitfire, Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Tonight, our show is dedicated to Loretta Saunders. We are in studio with Spitfire hosts Mercedes, Victoria, Gao, and myself, Alyssa.
This month, we bring you an interview on the intersection between HIV/AIDS prevention, sex work, and harm reduction. Last week, Alyssa sat down with Aziza Ahmed, who was in town talking about the importance of decriminalizing sex worker work for HIV prevention's efforts and the rights of sex workers. We'll bring you her interview.
Gao will be bringing a hot topic to the table this month, the recent phenomenon of the controversial American Apparel ad made in Bangladesh, featuring the image of a topless, quote-unquote, former Muslim woman and her transnational identity testimonial. I'm sure everyone has seen that floating around on the web. We're very excited to talk more about this crazy stunt in a roundtable.
All right. And tonight we're also really excited to have Montreal film and theater actress Lily join us remotely from Centaur Theater. We're going to talk about acting, Montreal theater, films, and what it's like to be a woman of color actress in Montreal.
Mercedes will also share some wise reflections on the recent social media campaigns of hashtag I2MHarvard and the similar campaign done in Oxford, the stakes involved, and pushbacks we've been witnessing in our cyber universes. So all this and more coming up right now on Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. And since spring is on the way, I'm trying to get my happy on, so we're going to bring you some of the best from the late 1980s and early 1990s women of color music. That's right. Free Your Mind, says En Vogue. That's Free Your Mind by En Vogue. Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio. It is just before 6:10. Once again, our show this month is dedicated to the memory of Loretta Saunders. And right now, we're going to go to a piece from Gao. Go ahead, Gao.
All right. So I've been seeing this piece kind of floating around the web these past few weeks. It's an American Apparel ad, and you know they're usually controversial, but this time it kind of struck a chord with me. Our first meeting with Max is made to be intimate. She poses for an American Apparel campaign selling a pair of high-waisted jeans that barely make the frame. With the line "Made in Bangladesh" splayed across her bare breasts, we're invited to take up a white male gaze over the racialized other in the flesh. A lengthy passage in American Apparel's characteristic small print Helvetica reads, "Meet Max." She's a merchandiser who has been working with American Apparel since 2010. Born in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, Max vividly remembers attending mosque as a child alongside her conservative Muslim parents. At age 4, her family made a life-changing move to Marina del Rey, California. Although she suddenly found herself in a world away from Dhaka, she continued to following her parents' religious traditions and sustained her Islamic faith throughout her childhood. Upon entering high school, Max began to feel the need for herself to forge her own identity and ultimately distanced herself from her Islamic traditions. A woman continuously in search of new creative outlets, Max unreservedly embraced the photo shoot. She's been found in some elements of Southern California culture to be immediately appealing, but is striving to explore what lies beyond the city's superficial pleasures. She doesn't feel the need to identify herself as American or Bangladeshi, and is not content to fit her life into anyone else's conventional narrative. That's what makes her essential to the mosaic that is Los Angeles, an unequivocally a distinct figure in the ever-expanding American Apparel family.
Barf.
Sorry. It goes on. It's so hard to read without just like... Max was photographed in the high-waist jean, a garment manufactured by 23 skilled American workers in downtown Los Angeles, all of whom are paid fair wage and have access to basic benefits such as health care. The ad seems to be a strategic way of highlighting the brand's fair labor practices and social conscience in light of 2013 the Rana Plaza garment factory collapse. The collapse, which took the lives of more than 1,100 garment workers and left thousands injured, occurred in Savar, a district of the greater Dhaka area in Bangladesh, after concerns over the building's crumbling infrastructure were ignored. So there was an interview conducted with the aptly named Fashionista.com with Iris Alonso, the creative director for American Apparel, and she said of the ad, "We found Max's background to be compelling for a variety of reasons, and the ad came from that. We're very proud of her and her bravery. This Made in Bangladesh..." can't even sometimes. "The Made in Bangladesh headline refers to the origin of the model as well as an issue of critical importance in the fashion industry, and is absolutely critical for the brands that are engaging in any sort of manufacturing to be ethically responsible. Garment manufacture is a difficult and skilled profession, and American Apparel's mission for the last 15 years has been to prove that it can be done without exploiting or endangering the people behind the machines. Because the point is not where the factory is, but how the people inside it are being treated." Now, I don't know if you guys know, but Dov Cherney, the CEO of American Apparel, is constantly under fire for sexually exploiting and harassing his young employees. And, you know, it's kind of funny that Alonso mentions this. I was wondering, given the context, what you ladies think.
Okay, I don't even know where to begin.
It's begin. Just...
Yeah, Victoria, go. You know what I mean.
Like,
I
don't know, it seems like you have a lot to say.
Yeah. I'm like looking at your face.
Like, you're like ready to explode right now.
Okay, first of all, okay, what I found kind of, okay, there's just a lot to unpack here, right?
Right.
So, just visually, like you have this beautiful woman, this beautiful Bangladesh woman who's basically like bare chested with, you know, totally topless with the words made in Bangladesh, just stamped across her, like some kind of like export product stamp, you know, made in Bangladesh. And she's, you know, her jeans are undone. And then it has this like wonderful testimonial that Gao shared with us all about how, you know, she doesn't feel comfortable in, you know, these national identities, and she's coming from this, you know, she was this Muslim person, and then she moved to Los Angeles, and her identity is all fluid, and she's eschewing narratives of conventional narratives of who she is, and you get this image of her as this completely sexualized, objectified, like hyper sexed up, you know, commodity. Where do I want to start with that? Well, it's just, I don't know. There's just so many ways in which I can say that that's, I don't see how that would, you know, I don't see how that's like a wonderful way to like eschew, like, you know, conventional narratives of femininity or, you know, transnationality or what it means to be a woman or what it means to be a Bangladesh woman. What does it mean to be a Bangladesh woman inscribed in the fashion industry, given like the recent fire that, you know, the fashion industry is under for their horrible sweatshop, you know, workers' realities, especially in Bangladesh, with thousands of people dying recently in horrible working conditions, and, you know, with the fire earlier in 2013. So, I don't know. I'll come back, but I have more things to say. But
I don't know. I just feel like throughout this entire campaign, it's kind of like it. I don't think it is liberating in a way. It just feels like it's like, I don't know, the idea that America is the place to feel liberated, thus that women in these conditions feel like this is how I'm going to associate myself and kind of be like the liberated American woman. But yet at the same time, like, we take that and kind of appropriate it to our own twisted needs. And even like the commentary you're making where they're like, people are saying how they're proud of her. I just feel like that kind of even that doesn't even sexualize her anymore. It just infantilizes her as someone who just needs to get like a pat on the back, being like, good for you, girl, like, you broke out of your shell. And like, that's just not right. And like, even this ad campaign itself is just doing that. It's just like, here's a pat on the back for trying to step out of your box without actually stepping out of your box. And I feel like it's just, I don't know,
totally,
like, it's kind of disturbing for me, I guess, just to think about it. But
so, you know what it reminds me of? So, do you guys know who Elizabeth Hasselbeck is?
No.
She was on The View for a while, right? She got her start on The View by, I'm going somewhere with this, don't worry.
No, wait, she was on Survivor, right?
She was on Survivor, and that's how she got on The View. The View is like a all-woman panel talk show of women of diverse ages and races. So there's Whoopi Goldberg, Sherry Shepherd, both of them are African-American. Jenny McCarthy is a new host, and then there's Barbara Walters, who's kind of like the executive director. Anyways, so Elizabeth Hasselbeck was known famously on the show for being kind of the sole explicitly Republican American voice. And she one time like had this segment where she was talking about how walking down New York City with her daughter, and her daughter, who's white, had like her favorite doll was this like brown doll that was clearly a woman, a racialized woman who was like either South Asian or like not like from South Asian descent, and how like her daughter was looked at like, why do you have that doll? And it was so messed up though, because like Elizabeth Hasselbeck is like a right-wing Republican. Like, I think she's pro same-sex marriage, but pretty much the rest of her opinions on like a series of, I guess, policies are pretty like right-wing. So it felt like she was kind of using like cultural politics and like cultural analysis to advance some kind of point that she was post-racial, and that the problem was society looking at her and her daughter in this like really like horrible way when she was just trying to be like cosmopolitan in New York City. And it kind of feels like like a similar sentiment being evoked, not by the woman herself, but by like the text that like you're like using cultural politics and kind of appropriating like complexity and like hybridity and like, you know, like marginalized women's experiences for the purpose of seeming like sexy and nuanced. Like it's almost this weird form of hipsterism where like, you know, the whole point of hipster racism is to be in on the joke at the same time as you make fun of how racist it is, which is essentially a performance of racism, if usually if you're white. And that's how this ad feels to me.
All right. So before we wrap this up, I have a few points myself. So, I mean, the whole thing highlights the conditions of the garment factory worker, but in a sense, it's actually highlighting her perceived otherness and kind of racializing her to the point that she's invisible. She's kind of like depicted as this sexually repressed woman under an indigenous religious patriarchy. And, you know, it's up to Western feminism to save her and liberate her once again. And I'm just tired of that so much. I mean, like her Mac's whole narrative speaks about kind of a journey from like one space to another. And she equates Islam with her upbringing and a regressive sexual constriction of the Muslim woman by Islam, and then contrast it with the progressive sexual politics that secularism in America is assumed to offer.
Totally, yeah.
So
totally
this is kind
bipolar. Of bipolar.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like purveying Islamophobia and xenophobia under the guise of feminist empowerment, and that's complete BS.
And those also, are the two options, right?
Yeah.
Like those are the only two options. It's like pick the West or pick this like racist depiction of like, you know, repressive, you know, religious, like Muslim reality. Oh, okay. Here's an interview. Sorry. Sorry.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
That's your interview calling? Who's
gonna... Yeah, that's okay. Our next interview calling.
That was that noise, sorry. Ladies and gentlemen.
Live radio, y'all.
Never a dull moment.
Community. So yeah, I agree. And also, what is this thing with like needing to like this obsession with either women who are perceived or identified as Muslim? Because not even, it's like sometimes people who are perceived as being Muslim aren't even actually Muslim. It's just this like way to like put them like in the East, like they're over there. But like either they're like super covered, and then there's like this obsession with like unveiling. And like the unveiling is like this paradox of like hypersexualizing, like sort of participating in rape culture, if not, you know, like outrightly sexually assaulting, and at the same time like liberating, as you said, Gal. Right. Like it's like the charter of values. It's like the only way to like liberate and to participate in the secular society is to like remove the veil, at least when you're in public, so that we can have like gender equality.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, the woman's body kind of stands in as the truth. Like, her body in the flesh is, like, universal for womanhood. And so that's why unveiling is such a phenomenon. Anyway, we're going to wrap this up and
thank you, Gal. Congratulations on facilitating your first discussion in studio. Yeah. For those of you listening, Gal is our newest and baddest member.
All right. We're gonna wrap it up with a bit of a song, impromptu song session.
All together through our beliefs, we are like-minded individuals sharing a common vision, pushing toward a world rid of color lines.
That was Rhythm Nation by the legendary Janet, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. You're listening to Spitfire Woman of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. Once again, we are dedicating our whole show to the memory of Loretta Saunders. We miss you, Loretta. All right, passing the mic now to Victoria.
Hi. So this segment is for all the theater lovers out there and aspiring women of color actresses. Tomorrow night, the Centaur Theater will launch the Canadian premiere of Amy Herzog's award-winning play, The 4,000 Miles. And tonight, we're really lucky to have two of the actresses from the play talk with us tonight about their play, their work, and the Montreal theater and film scene. So hi, Leanna Montoro and Lily. Are you there?
We're here. How are you?
Really doing really, really well. So, yeah. So let's talk about the play. What's it about, and what are the themes that are being explored, and what do you like about it?
Okay, so we're working on 4,000 Miles. It's a play by Amy Herzog. This play is set in 2007, so we'd say fairly dated, and it mostly deals with Leo, who's traveled, who's done a travel around the country in the States, and there's been a horrible accident with his friend, Micah, who passes. It was a tragedy. He ends up getting killed, or we can say it's fairly unexpected. However, he goes to New York in hopes that he meets his girlfriend to reconcile with his girlfriend, because he hasn't been in contact with anyone during the trip, and She's not really willing to speak with him, because he's been, I guess you can say, in denial, and he's isolated himself from everyone else. So he ends up going to his grandmother's house, Vera, in hopes to spend the night, and then he continues his travels, or hopes that Beck, his girlfriend, will reconcile with him. And it's really an interesting dynamic between his grandmother and himself. And just the themes that are brought about in this play, from politics to love and loss, relationships. You want to add anything else, Lily?
Yeah, but just saying that this is still a light drama. Mm-hmm. It's not as dark as...
Yeah.
Okay, so it's entertaining.
When you first get the story, you know, it doesn't exactly start off as dramatic as it may seem, but there is some interesting topics that are brought about, but it's definitely a light drama. Vera, being the grandmother, she definitely has a lot of inspiration in her, and
you know, when people get really old, they start to have the liberty to be kind of mean, but it's endearing. That's who Vera is. She can speak her mind without being afraid of anything. So this play is really everyone's cup of tea, because I know that people our age love it, and we had two previews already, and there's just laughter throughout the whole play.
Awesome. So tell us more about the characters you two play. Lily, I remember you once told me that you're interested in taking on roles that you can identify with, like, you know, that you have to kind of find the character in yourself to be able to take on that role. So, like, from either of you, like, what was the process like for you learning about the character that you play? Any discoveries or insights, you know, when you had to bring her to life, or bring these characters to life on stage?
Well, I was really fortunate to find this role, because it's very rare to find an Asian character who's not in computer science. It's not stereotyped. I know. So my character is a design art student. She's studying at Parsons in New York, which is one of the most privileged design schools in the world. And she's a second generation. She speaks her mind, and she's a bit crazy in a good way. And Leanna's character, I'll let Leanna talk about her character, which is really super interesting as well.
Yes, so I play Rebecca, which is Leo's girlfriend. And the thing about Beck is that she's an overachiever, and she's just started her first year in college in New York, you know, so she's come from St. Paul, like a smaller town city, and she's very ambitious, highly ambitious, and wants to do well and please everyone. So it's, for me, it's really intriguing to play a character close to yourself, that kind of, when you've evolved and you've changed, but you can kind of go back and be like, wow, I remember that. I remember having to, you know, prove myself and work hard. And so she's just really a very overachiever, passionate young girl, I would say, young lady.
She would be like a young Hillary Clinton or a young Obama.
That's cool. And that's cool that she's being represented by a person of color.
Yes, definitely. Which was intriguing to me because when I went in for the reading, there was not exactly, there was not really a position of where Beck's background is from. So approaching this role, I took it full front and just went with my gut feeling and what I think I could bring to this role, versus it being Lily, where it was very distinct and specific. And
yeah, I mean, my role for Amanda, it was written as a Chinese American. So for me, I really felt very fortunate that Amy wrote this role. And I guess we both feel very fortunate because we have the person who plays Vera, Claire, she is such a phenomenal actress. And she's just really at least helped me along my journey with the Centaur Theater. I feel very honored.
Well, we are definitely both honored to be working with her. She's quite the woman, I would say, and I think for her to be taking on this role, it's been wonderful to watch. I would definitely say that.
Yeah, and we're both very fortunate that we were friends before the show, and we're both debuting
in our first Centaur show together, which is, I would say, very
pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
I'm so happy to hear that. I'm just expand on this concept of, like, you know, finding the roles that are for you. Just to skip to that other question that I had prepared for you, like, tell us more about the theater and film scene in general in Montreal, like, as women of color, like, are you finding the kinds of roles that you want to play? Are there, like, do you find that it's, like, opening up right now? Are we going through, like, a cultural paradigm shift? Or are there still the same barriers? And if there are those barriers, like, how do you overcome them? Like, how do you find the opportunities that you need to, like, you know, exercise your creative potential?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I guess, personally, in my point of view, I think it's slowly starting to open up. And it also has to do with writers writing the roles that we can audition for. I mean, I don't think I can audition for most of Midwestern. If the role calls for a Caucasian, you have a Caucasian brother, sometimes you have to stick to the reality of the play.
Yeah.
And but I do think as long as there are writers and playwrights out there who's writing roles for us, I think that's going to help. What do you think, Leanna?
No, I can definitely agree with that. It's, in terms of roles available for women of color, it's a tricky thing, you know, because you have roles that are specifically for women of color and you have roles that are specifically for Caucasian women, but then you have that beautiful gap between the two where, for example, my character, Beck, you know, it's Amy. I'm fortunate that I'm sure there's been wonderful productions and the Becks might be all different. And for that, I'm always eager for those kind of roles because as much as I go into theater to be on stage, it's lovely to be able to understand that writers have their vision and to respect that, but also understand that I always have something to offer. So when I go into a role, even if it's, unless it's completely, you know, Caucasian, I always go with that in mind that I'm a woman, I'm an actress, and I'm there to do my work, really. And it's definitely evolving, I would say. Definitely changing. There's more writers who are intertwining stories.
I think it also has to do with the theater goers demanding that kind of plays being put on. I mean, if you come to see a play and you are not going to see the plays that featuring women of color or whatnot, and those plays don't get sold out, then it's going to be very difficult later on. Whereas if when you put on plays for women of color and they're starting to get sold out and stuff like that, then theaters and other venues are more inclined to put on shows such featuring more people
exactly.
of color. Yeah,
definitely.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for that insight. I don't know how much time we have. We have a couple of minutes left. Maybe we can tackle the question of getting some of our audience members excited about life again through the culture that's available. Like, I asked you guys earlier to think on your favorite women of color artists who are out there producing things, either as directors or actresses, or any cool films or plays that are being put out right now that we can like access that, you know, speak to our experiences. What do you guys have to share? Bring me the goods.
bring you the goods of the women of color that are out in Montreal.
Or not even in Montreal, maybe out in the world. Yeah.
Well, I'll start with Montreal because
cool.
Definitely, there's some great actresses out there, and I would say I look up to Lucinda Davis.
Yeah, she's great.
She has been working for over, I would say, 20 years, but she's been 10 years about in film and TV, and she's consistently working in theater in Montreal, and she's a very humble girl. Love asking her anything about just what it feels like, and she always goes about the same way for me. I mean, I've worked with her, and she tells me, you know, you just go in there knowing that you have a job to do, and it's your right, and I completely acknowledge that. And as an artist outside,
I'm going to include Christine Lang, who's also in our show. You don't see her, well, you see her on stage, but you don't see her physically, so you'll get it when you come see the show. She was my role model when I first started in acting, so I feel very fortunate that we get to share the stage with her. So Christine Lang, if you're listening, hi.
Okay, so that's Christine Lang, and the other one was
Lucinda Davis.
So Lucinda Davis, Christine Lang. We're running out of time, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. I just wanted to give a plug for your, you know, performance that starts tomorrow is the official premiere. So that's Thursday night, 8:00, Centaur Theater. If you go check out centaurtheater.com, you can buy some tickets and you'll see that like the show is going to be running for the next 2 weeks. So there are a lot of different opportunities for you to watch it. I'm super excited to see it. Thank you so much, guys, for joining us. I'd love to have you guys in studio next time, maybe when the play wraps up. So thanks a lot so much for joining us today again.
Oh, thanks for having you.
Okay, good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Victoria, for that very interesting interview with Lily and Leanna Montoro. And now I'm just going to get into this trending social phenomenon, the hashtag #I2AmHarvard, that's been going on in the States. And it's kind of a little rant, so bear with me. So on August 28th, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had given his famous I Have a Dream speech as part of the March on Washington demonstration. I would now like to read a little excerpt from the speech that rings true to its title. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis. An oasis? I lost my spot. Sorry. Oh my gosh.
Okay, sorry. you're gonna have to just like go back to the top of that paragraph because I was in terror. I want to feel the rhythm again. So
okay, so sorry guys. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident and that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed in an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. Yes, Dr. King did have a dream, but it seems that this dream has been forgotten. However, if it has not been forgotten, then it clearly is being ignored. It would seem that individuals are to remain unequal. Individuals are not to sit at the same table of brotherhood, but most importantly, it would seem that individuals are just destined to be judged by the color of their skin rather than by the content of their character. Why I say that is because of the recent trend that I came across while on my Facebook newsfeed. Now, living in an age of technology where social media is the way to keep up and follow current events, there is no way that what I discovered could have gone unnoticed. And unnoticed, it did not go. At first, I thought it was a joke. I thought there was no way that something like what I was reading about could happen again. Sadly, it was happening. The article I was reading about was concerning the trending hashtag #I2AmHarvard, a project started by Kimiko Matsuda Lawrence, who conducted an independent study that saw her interview more than 40 Black Harvard students. Although these students may not have known each other, they all had one thing in common. They all experienced racism and the blunt end of white privilege and the backhand of ignorance. It seems that because they attend an Ivy League school, somehow it is not plausible that maybe, just maybe, they did it on their own merit, with hard work, good support structure, a good education, most of all, not by the color of their skin. But God forbid that their white classmates be able to accept that. Each student is photographed with an ignorant statement that has been said to them while attending the institution, such as, "Can you read?" "Don't you wish you were white like the rest of us?" Or, "You're lucky to be black. You can get into college easily." These statements are absurd. Considering that these are individuals who claim to attend an institution of higher learning, this is definitely not reflected in their thought process. In this day and age, this is not the sort of statements that should continue to be made. This is inherent in how these other white students interact with their black colleagues. Now, as a black woman attending McGill University, I just have this to say. For all of those still stuck on their high horses, it's time for you to get off of it. Get over yourselves. Black students do attend your institutions, and it's time to accept that they are at the same intellectual level, if not more, as you. Get used to seeing their faces in your classes and on your campuses, because they are not going anywhere. #, we're here to stay.
Thank you so much, Mercedes.
That was amazing.
Thank you.
Join CKUT for a benefit screening of Lizzie Borden's 1983 film, Born in Flames. Set in New York City, the film portrays a group of women who take revolution further than anyone could ever imagine. Gender empowerment, feminism, and the intricacies in between. Co-presented with Dragonroot Radio, Cooper McGill, and the Union for Gender Empowerment. A speaker and moderated discussion to follow the screening by donation Monday, March 31st, 6 p.m. at the Thompson House, 3650 McTavish.
Black women, be ready. White women, get ready. Red women, stay ready, for this is our time.
Diseases like measles, polio, and whooping cough are passed from child to child. Babies and children used to die from these diseases. Now they don't have to. Protect your child from childhood diseases by having them vaccinated on time.
Don't wait. Vaccinate. Talk to your healthcare provider or visit healthcanada.gc.ca/vaccinate. A message from Health Canada.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to a special edition of Spitfile, Women of Color Radio, 90.3 FM on CKUT. The time is 6:42, and we're going to go to Alyssa's interview with Professor Aziza Ahmed in just
a second. Northeastern University, and is an expert in health law, human rights, property law, and international law. Her scholarship focuses on issues of both domestic and international law. Professor Ahmed also examines challenges facing Muslim minority communities post 9/11. Professor Ahmed holds a JD from the University of California, Berkeley, an MS in Population and International Health from the Harvard School of Public Health, and a BA from Emory University. Professor Ahmed has worked on legal issues in a variety of country contexts, including South Africa, Namibia, India, the United States, and the Caribbean, and has worked with various United Nations agencies and international and domestic non-governmental organizations. Aziza spoke at McGill University on March 20th as part of the Concordia University HIV/AIDS Project's annual community lecture series. Her talk, entitled "Do Anti-Trafficking Initiatives Undermine the HIV Response? Examining the Unintended Consequences," discussed the ways that policies and laws developed as a response to sex trafficking have the paradoxical effect of making it more difficult for sex workers to protect themselves from HIV infection and other risks. This was also the subject of her workshop on March 21st. We caught up with Aziza on March 21st after the workshop at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute on Concordia University's campus. Thank you so much, Aziza, for joining me today after your talk last night and your workshop this afternoon at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute. I guess I want to start out by asking you to talk about the connection between HIV prevention and sex work advocacy.
At the beginning of the HIV epidemic, sex workers were often treated as vectors, so as people who were spreading HIV from one person to another. And today we see, partly because of a large amount of funding going to sex work and harm reduction programs, a wonderful sex work movement that's responding to that and really empowering themselves in the context of the HIV epidemic. Early in the epidemic, some populations of people were treated as though they were the ones spreading HIV. That included gay men, it includes Haitians, injecting drug users, and sex workers were also one of those groups. So the idea was that sex workers were sort of carrying HIV around, infecting innocent people.
So as you know, the Supreme Court of Canada recently struck down the three laws in the criminal code that criminalized sex work. Essentially, sex work was never illegal, but everything around sex work was legal. So can you talk about why you think it's important to decriminalize sex work?
I think it's important to decriminalize sex work because we really want to bring what is a very marginalized population into the open. And when we bring sex work into the open, we can regulate sex work and the sex industry like we regulate any other industry. And we can move forward with labor laws. We can move forward to really think about how to protect sex workers. And sex workers can call on the state for protection instead of fearing that if they call on the state, they or their client might be prosecuted in the course of that.
So the Supreme Court gave Parliament a year to draft new laws. There's been a lot of debate about what those laws might look like, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the problems with responses to sex work that criminalize the purchasers of sex. This is famously referred to as the Nordic model.
Well, the Nordic model, as you said, it criminalizes people who purchase sex. The objective behind that is to punish essentially the men who are purchasing sex from women. Now, this is a problem because if you criminalize clients of sex workers, it essentially creates a situation that is similar to actually criminalizing sex work. Because if the idea is that we're making sex work safer for women or we want to protect women, it doesn't make sense to send them after their clients in dark areas, dark alleys, into unprotected areas, places where they can't have a bodyguard, places where they can't take another sex worker potentially. So we really have to think about that. Now, from the perspective of someone who thinks about these with regards to race issues as well, we might be very skeptical of any program or any solution that actually seeks to strengthen the criminal response to this. I think what many of us know is that it's actually people of color, it's men of color that will be targeted in programs like this.
So what are some alternative proposals?
So one of the main alternative proposals comes from New Zealand, but generally speaking, what people would like to see is that we actually bring the sex industry above ground. We regulate it as we would any other profession or any other job, that we enact labor standards that protect the sex workers, and that we allow sex workers to gain protection from the state. Making sex work safer, making it a better industry for people to work in, is a very different model from criminalizing it and trying to get rid of it.
You last night in your talk and today at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute workshop talked a lot about the tensions in feminism about the issue of sex work. Can you talk about those debates for our audience?
Feminists tend to take two positions on sex work. One is the abolitionist perspective, which suggests that all prostitution should be eliminated, that prostitution is at the crux of women's subordination to men. And that's where we get the Nordic model from. So that's where we get the idea that we should criminalize clients and punish the men who use sex work. The other feminist position is a sex positive position. It's a pro-harm reduction position. And by that I mean it's not about eliminating sex work. It's about making sex work safer. So this has really played out in the HIV debates, because harm reduction people and activists and sex workers and sex positive feminists really want to decriminalize, to make the sex work safer, to make it possible to access marginalized people, to give them better public health information, to give them tools for their health, condoms, etc. Whereas the abolitionists have really felt as though any work to support sex work programs is supporting trafficking, because to them, all sex work is trafficking. And so what we see is a tension inside of feminism that plays out in HIV, and that tension especially can have a really negative impacts for women in the sex industry and who are sex workers.
Talk about the hysteria around anti-trafficking, and that's conjured up in the media that you mentioned in your presentation.
Yeah. While sex work can be, like any other industry, there can be exploitation in the sex industry. And trafficking is also very exploitative. Often what we see in the media is a sort of hysterical response to this. And it amps up our desire to arrest people, to prosecute people, to punish people. It amps up our desire to put this in the realm of, and into the hands of the police to deal with that. We see this in the blogs written by, and the op-eds, I'm sorry, written by Nicholas Kristof, who writes about raiding brothels and rescuing women. We see this on Lifetime television and popular movies about people whose daughters are kidnapped into the sex industry or into sex slavery. And, you know, typically, and especially in the movie depiction of this, it does tend to be sort of an innocent white girl, an innocent white woman who's kidnapped into this broader organized crime situation. And it really plays on people's fears and fantasies, I think, of what happens to our image of sort of a pure, chaste young woman when she is sort of exposed to this criminal element in society. And that's a very racialized story.
So you've kind of alluded to race in your talks. I'm wondering if you can talk about kind of what your sense is of the different experiences that sex workers of color and that indigenous sex workers encounter in the sex industry.
Well, you know, a lot of sex workers of color, there have been articles written by sex workers of color specifically talking about how they feel like they were utilized for sort of racial fantasies. And that's a compromised position to be in, because on one hand, you're doing your job, and on the other hand, someone is exploiting your racial experience or racial history for their sex fantasy. So this creates a lot of tension in trying to understand how to actually deal with this in the context of still acknowledging that, you know, we need to make sex work safer. Sex workers of color do face a great amount of discrimination And it's difficult to say that they face more or less because a lot of this has to do with class. In Canada, there's many accounts of violence specifically targeting First Nations women. So in the Canadian context, we have a very clear connection between these two. What we especially see, and I know this to be a fact in the case of trans sex workers, is that no matter what the law is, it's the sex worker that gets punished. So it could be, you know, that let's say we have a situation where sex work itself is decriminalized, but pimping is illegal. It's often the people of color or the trans people that continue to get arrested under those same laws and charged under those same laws. Women of color are definitely marginalized inside of the sex industry itself. Now, the sex industry for women, for female sex workers, these are women who are struggling and marginalized as a whole. And so sometimes the racial difference might even be nuanced. And, you know, there are also instances of, in the prostitution free zones in Washington, D.C., where police can stop women and search them if they are believed to be engaged in prostitution-related activities, that it is probably more likely that if you're a black woman, you're going to get stopped.
Your work has tracked a lot of the laws passed in the United States and that are anti-trafficking and anti-sex work, and you talked about how these laws emerged shortly after the start of the War on Terror in the Bush administration. I'm just wondering if you could map out that trajectory for our audience.
Right, so the connection there would be that the HIV laws that were put into place, so the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, for example, was put into place shortly after Bush started the War on Terror, and it was seen as sort of an act of humanitarianism for the Bush administration, you know, a sort of conservative humanitarianism that was enacted around the same time as the War on Terror. And, you know, we saw conservative policies being enacted through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So there was provisions for abstinence-only education, there was provisions for faith-based organizations to receive funding, and then we had the Anti-Prostitution Loyalty Oath that essentially facilitated the defunding of sex worker organizations and funding more conservative organizations that were willing to take positions that the U.S. government supported, and that position was that we should eliminate prostitution. The broader trajectory of all of this can be put inside of the rise of neoliberal policies in the post-war time, but especially in the 1980s, around the time of the Reagan administration. And what we see there is generally a trend towards pushing for the use of criminal law as a solution to social problems or as a response to social problems.
You spoke about work you did in India, and I'm wondering if you can recount some of that experience that you had there and what you saw.
You know, what you see in India, and this is in Sangli, it's in a city that's on the border of Maharashtra and Karnataka. You know, to get there, you have to fly to Pune, which is a city, and then drive 5 hours internally. And then you get there and you realize that you found yourself in the battle of anti-trafficking over sex work. And it's a really strange experience to have because you're with women, you're with peer educators who are trying to deliver HIV services, and because they're trying to deliver HIV services to sex workers, anti-trafficking organizations are saying that they're forwarding a trafficking agenda. And so you have this ongoing raiding of safe brothels, you have a raiding of organizations and the various facilities that they have, and the various brothels that they keep that are sort of part of a system of homes and brothels and sex work collective spaces where people can be safe. And it's disruptive, it's entirely disruptive to their ability to deliver HIV services.
Finally, bringing it back to the North American context, do you think that the opening that the Supreme Court has created opens the door to possible broader coalitions around prison reform and decriminalization of drugs and a wider array of harm reduction responses?
I hope so. I hope that the decriminalization of sex work is a signal, you know, that the courts are taking a more sensible and a more responsible approach to issues that are deemed to be highly controversial. You know, so it's not the Supreme Court listening to moralistic arguments about what we need to abolish in society, but it's the Supreme Court actually saying, look at these women and look at how marginalized they are and look at how they're being further marginalized by these laws that on their face perhaps sound like a good idea. But we're going to look beyond what the laws say on their face, and we're going to see what's actually happening on the ground and see how they're actually being enacted. And it's troubling what you actually see. Sex workers are being harmed by the very laws that are supposed to be protecting them. So yes, I hope we do see this in other contexts, you know, with regards to drugs, Especially, I hope we can move towards a more decriminalized framework that's operating without the sort of weight of the criminal law system on it, and allow us to better deal with the problems through harm reduction.
Aziza, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Aziza Ahmed, who was in Montreal talking about the detrimental impact of anti-sex trafficking laws and policies on HIV/AIDS prevention. Aziza is a professor of law at Northeastern University and has written on the intersections of feminism and sex worker rights and HIV treatment cases. These issues were contemplated in the recent Supreme Court of Canada case, Bedford v. Canada, where three provisions of the criminal code pertaining to prostitution were struck down. We spoke with her after her workshop at the Concordia University Simone de Beauvoir Institute. For Spitfire, this is Alyssa Clutterbuck.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks to everyone for listening, and a special thanks goes to tonight's guest, Professor Aziza Ahmed, Lily, and Liliana Montero. Don't forget to check out Lily and Liliana perform at the 4,000 Miles in the next week at the Centaur Theater. For tickets, check out centaurtheater.com.
Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio.
Peace, everyone. Do it, and do it, and do it, and do it, and do it. Do it.
Nothing gain, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high. From the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave. And I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me. Support me or snake me. Either way I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream. Just set the scene. Get screamed like how you mean. Straight up. On a string, like them hoes sucking on your thing, overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. If you're holding your breath for great God out the sky, best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. Just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, scheming on the come up. No day